This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. John Stark is in his first year as the artistic director of the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, and the Chicago Tribune ranks the festival number one in summer must-see events. Nothing like a little pressure.
Any nerves? Of course. It's sort of like the Field of Dreams, so if you plan it, will they come?
More on the summer season with Laura Kennedy, plus the blues and roots music of Samantha Fish, refreshing and varied. John Norton has more, and it's GLT's Grow. And a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from listener contributions to GLT, with additional support from Country Financial Representative Justin M. Boyd. Information at justinmboyd.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. There are many upsides to having a Fortune 50 company headquartered in Bloomington. Jobs, economic stability, partnerships with local schools, bragging rights, just to name a few. Here's a downside. When that giant company needs to pivot, it can be jarring. GLT's Ryan Denham explores the competitive pressures that are leading to big changes within State Farm by talking to industry watchers about where State Farm fits into a changing insurance industry.
If you're looking for clues about what State Farm is doing, don't just look to the big black building overlooking Veterans Parkway. Look at Rhode Island. That's where State Farm is experimenting with a new model for auto insurance. It's called High Road, and it's basically insurance by app. The app tracks how you drive and charges you more or less each month based on how safe or recklessly you drive. It's fast, with quotes in 5 minutes and claims you can file right through the app.
High Road is a great example of a concept that we developed within State Farm to look at auto insurance through a new lens.
That's Lorette Stiles, Vice President of State Farm's Strategic Resources Unit, which studies competitors and industry trends to guide internal decision-making. High Road is a direct-to-consumer move for State Farm, a company rooted in selling and servicing policies through its agents. In fact, State Farm's name is barely on High Road's website and app. You wouldn't even know it's owned by State Farm.
Sort of a new model, and get it out there in a market where they don't have that today. And we're operating very successfully on a very short timeline with a very interesting experiment and test that we're learning from.
State Farm is restructuring, raising concerns about what it means for the Bloomington normal economy. One day, the company says it's shedding 890 local IT jobs. The next, it says more claims and State Farm bank jobs are moving in. The drip, drip, drip of moves may sound unusual for a company known in the industry for workforce stability. Jacobson Group CEO Greg Jacobson produces a labor market study of the insurance industry.
I think more so than most insurance organizations, State Farm's workforce is made up of people who grow up in the business at State Farm. And that's kind of a unique thing in the insurance industry nowadays. You see people moving from one company to another company. You don't really see that often from State Farm.
One reason is State Farm is facing unusually stiff competition on two fronts. The Geicos and Progressives are still trying to chip away at State Farm's 84 million policies and accounts, and so are so-called insurtech startups like Lemonade, using technology to disrupt the market.
It's a good thing for consumers, but that is the level of competition has been very acute, very high.
That's Stephen Weisbart, chief economist for the Insurance Information Institute and Industry Research Group.
There's some new entrants coming into the marketplace with new ideas about how to market and how to deliver insurance.
State Farm leaders say competitive pressures require it to be more efficient. That means lowering expenses and therefore prices, and moving products and services to market more quickly. State Farm remains the largest insurer in the country, with nearly 20% of the home and auto insurance markets. State Farm wants to hold on to that market share. Vice President Lorette Stiles says change will be constant, not a project with some end date.
So products and services consider How many people do we need to do that? How can we do that most efficiently? And how does that impact the price of our product? So customers are interested in our products when they're competitively priced. That's all part of the equation.
One measure of efficiency is expense ratio. That's the percentage of premiums an insurer pays out as expenses, like employee salaries and agent commissions. State Farm's expense ratio last year was about 26%, according to S&P Global Market Intelligence. That's higher than competitors like Geico, Progressive, and USAA, but on par with the industry overall. Paul Newsom is a Chicago-based managing director in equity research at Sandler O'Neill & Partners. He watches State Farm's publicly traded competitors like Allstate and Travelers.
There is a pretty clear trend towards trying to reduce expenses within that industry.
Indeed, State Farm CFO John Farney said in March's annual financial report the company would become leaner and stronger. Company officials say the recent restructuring of State Farm's three IT departments into one will both streamline work and cut costs. The IT workforce still will shrink by 500 people company-wide. State Farm Bank is also cutting employees by about 18%. State Farm is against trend in cutting employees. The latest insurance labor market study from the Jacobson and Ward groups shows about 58% of insurers say they'd plan to add staff in the next year. Only about 11% plan to cut. Technology jobs are in the highest demand in the industry. Progressive is a top five auto insurer, too. They added 6,600 jobs in 2016, another 6,000 in 2017, and 1,000 already this year. Progressive CEO Tricia Griffith visited Illinois State University in February. She told GLT they've been growing like wildfire.
It's a balancing act of making sure you're lean, so you're cost competitive, but also that you hire enough people to help out, especially when a claim happens.
The VP from State Farm, Lorette Stiles, pushes back on State Farm as outlier.
State Farm is actually heavily invested in information technology and the solutions that we develop through IT. So even though we are reducing positions in Bloomington, we are adding hundreds of positions in our hub locations of Atlanta, Dallas, and Phoenix.
Tom Super, the director of global insurance practice at J.D. Power, says State Farm is not unique in what it's doing. It's just more visible because it's the biggest.
But if you look across all of the major carriers, there has been major restructuring that has been taking place.
One example, shifting resources toward customer call centers instead of agent call centers.
The industry is shifting from being focused primarily on channels to being driven by consumer preferences, right? So as a result, you need to reorient the support model to be able to deliver against that.
The average insurance customer's expectations have changed significantly, particularly with technology. That's according to Ellen Carney, a principal analyst at Forrester Research, who studies e-business strategy. She says an experience on Amazon.com or travel website can influence demands from an insurer's website or app.
They're bringing these expectations with them. They think, gosh, it should be the same kind of capabilities and ease of buying insurance coverage or filing a claim that I can do all these things, you know, with these other companies I do business with, you know, in my life as a consumer. And, of course, it's different. It's harder.
Harder because of baked-in industry challenges, like customers who carry different types of insurance products with information maintained on separate systems. Carney's research shows that State Farm fell behind competitors on mobile or phone-based services for auto policyholders from 2013 to 2015. But in 2017, State Farm's score on Forrester's study rebounded, slightly beating the industry average.
They've adjusted quite well. As I said, you know, there was a period of time where they weren't paying attention to this, and then it was all of a sudden someone sat up, you know, in Bloomington and said, oh my God, we're falling behind, and you know, this is what customers are expecting.
Carney's team noted State Farm's improving mobile tools, such as a depreciation calculator that helps customers avoid overpaying on coverage as their vehicles age. State Farm is accustomed to digital brinksmanship with Geico and Progressive. It's now fending off challenges from a new breed of competitor, insurtech startups. Take Lemonade, an app-driven insurer that touts 90-second quotes. Cheap, Lemonade says monthly subscriptions for homeowners insurance start at $25, and its tagline, forget everything you know about insurance. Lemonade made waves last year when it touted a customer's claim that was paid in just 3 seconds, including time to run 13 anti-fraud algorithms against it.
And everyone's hair was on fire. And I said, listen, you guys have to be really careful because there's fast and there's good.
Here's Ellen Carney again from Forrester Research.
And there's certain situations where you want a human involved. And that's what makes it a good claims experience, when someone is empathetic and you have that chance to, you know, vent and complain about the other driver and how stupid they were, or whatever the situation was. You run the risk of missing the good by pushing more of this stuff onto, you know, onto the shoulders of customers, even with cool digital tools.
Lorette Stiles from State Farm says they're learning from competitors like Lemonade, particularly speeding up the pace of work. High Road, that State Farm InsurTech affiliate in Rhode Island, launched relatively quickly.
In any industry, disruptors are useful. They may not have any one of them a long lifespan, but they offer a different way of thinking about approaching the business and approaching the customer experience.
So why did High Road start in Rhode Island? One reason may be that State Farm didn't have agents there already. Elsewhere in the U.S., Stiles says State Farm's nearly 19,000 agents remain a central part of its business strategy. She says State Farm considers its agents what sets it apart from its competitors. Indeed, agents feature prominently in many State Farm TV commercials.
So you'll be here to help if I need you?
Kyle, I got you.
Okay. What about here?
Yep.
According to data from Kantar Media, State Farm's ad spending hit $98 million in 2017. That's up from $60 million the year before. That's continuing an upward climb. State Farm doesn't comment publicly on its ad spending. One reason State Farm may be hesitant to turn away from agents is customer loyalty. The average State Farm customer has been with the company for 14 years. The average for Progressive is 5 years, and just 6 years for Geico. That's according to research from Forrester. Here's Ellen Carney.
Because of that duration of the relationship, do wield a lot of power for, you know, within insurance companies. So, you know, they might want to do digital capabilities on mobile devices or Alexa or whatever, and, you know, then you have the fear of, you know, do we want to alienate our agent community?
Officials at the National Association of State Farm Agents did not return repeated requests for comment. Lorette Stiles from State Farm downplayed any tension between digital evolution and agents.
Actually, our agents are enthused about many of the changes that we're making because they see themselves the importance of an organization operating efficiently, streamlining processes, delivering more quickly solutions to customers.
Companies like State Farm and Allstate that use agents tend to have higher expense ratios than competitors like Progressive and Geico that sell insurance primarily online. That's according to Kevin Algram, an associate professor in the Department of Finance, Insurance, and Law at Illinois State University.
Having an agency system, it can be very expensive, but there's also some benefits to having agents, specifically, for example, when a policyholder has a claim, to actually maybe have a relationship with one of those claimants can make the difference between the customer being satisfied and, you know, just not being satisfied.
Paul Newsom, the analyst who watches publicly traded insurers, says distribution will be a challenge for State Farm and other agent-driven insurers in the years to come.
From a distribution perspective, it's in the wrong general bucket for sort of long-term distribution. It'll be a challenge for them to change the technology that their agents use and the company uses to address the changing ways that people buy insurance.
Tom Super with J.D. Power says State Farm remains in a very strong financial position, with a capital position that's unmatched. And that's despite a particularly brutal 2017 for insurers across the country. Separate California wildfires, hurricanes, and hailstorms last year were among the top 25 costliest events in company history.
The question is all these competitors rise and look to steal share from State Farm, how will the company want to position themselves to make sure that they're not losing share to some of these competitors, specifically around price-driven consumers that are looking for price messaging, and how will State Farm be able to compete with that?
State Farm's overall financial strength was cited as it recently lowered auto rates for Illinois customers. State Farm insures about one of every three vehicles in Illinois. Here's Stephen Weisbart with the Insurance Information Institute.
As the largest company, State Farm, in some sense, is really everybody's target.
So far, State Farm appears to be holding on to its market share. Its 18.3% of the auto market in 2016 was relatively unchanged. Its homeowners market share has dropped a bit, though, down from a peak of 21.9% in 2010 to about 19.2% in 2016. I'm Ryan Denham.
Support for GLT comes from ESA, Eye Surgical Associates, providing innovative treatment and vision-correcting surgeries for a wide range of eye conditions, including cataracts, macular degeneration, diabetic retinopathy, and glaucoma. You can see the difference at eyesurgicalassociates.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a preview of a new artistic director and a first season for him at the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. Teachers and administrators in Illinois say kids are coming to school with more acute mental health needs, and they say that's because many students suffer from the effects of trauma. One thing that can cause increased trauma, rising community violence. As Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines reports, while schools can't control what happens in the community, teachers can control how they react to traumatized kids.
Having a caring school environment, me liking school, is a protective factor that helps me overcome all kinds of adversity.
Mental health counselor Karen Sims is teaching roughly a dozen people in a church in Champaign about the effects of trauma on the brain. Most of them are educators worried about their students. Gun violence in the university town has increased in the last 7 years. And last December, three people were shot outside a high school basketball game. Lindsay Aikman teaches at Champaign Centennial High School. She tells the group that one of her students recently told her he has death anxiety.
He's like, I feel like I'm gonna die. Like, I never felt that way until I became a junior, and now I'm scared of it all the time.
Exposure to violence is one of many causes of trauma, and decades of research shows that trauma early in life changes a child's brain, leading to poor health later in life. But the research also indicates that with the right intervention, children's brains can bounce back. Christine Argue with the Illinois Education Association says the IEA has made trauma training a priority because the need has reached a crisis level.
So if we don't eradicate this public health crisis, it will only fester and get worse.
There's academic risks for students, too. A study in Chicago showed that children living on the same block where a murder occurred performed worse on reading tests within a week of the homicide. Sims, the counselor leading the trauma training, says if you don't address the underlying trauma, kids can't succeed academically. Aikman says that that's what brought her to Sims training.
We have kids walking around with chronic PTSD. We have kids like repressing the violence that they've seen, the fear that they have of not graduating. We've got to do better. There has to be better.
So how can teachers do better? Elizabeth DeGree is the special education director for Champaign Schools. She recently started training teachers there to think differently about their students. She says a trauma-informed school is a place
where adults ask themselves relative to kids' behavior, not what is wrong with you, but what has happened to you.
Researchers who study trauma say to do that, schools need to assess the emotional and social needs of students, not just academics, and then create an environment where every child feels safe and supported by the adults at school. This includes shifting from a discipline model that's purely punitive to one that teaches better behavior. DeGree says that cultural shift is a challenge. So when she's training educators to make that mental leap, she focuses on the science.
This is not about a touchy-feely, everybody be nice to each other kind of thing. There is real research science. This is based in something that is beyond what you might look at as being soft.
Argue, who does this work for the IEA, says people who don't understand the science behind trauma and the brain can make false assumptions about how to help kids. That's why building awareness around the research is the first step. She says the hope is that educators who receive this training return to their communities and teach others about the effects of trauma. Then, she says, they can make that cultural shift.
Now, in this training, it isn't that you're coming to get a box of tricks to take back to your work site to change kids. It's really more of an opportunity to begin a paradigm shift that has to happen.
But to do this work efficiently and effectively, experts say the entire community, local government, businesses, police, and the schools all need to make that paradigm shift. It's a slow process, Argue says, and the lack of urgency worries her.
While we're trying to pull people together, while we're trying to convince people that this is real and that it isn't going anywhere, there are casualties. I mean, figuratively and literally. It scares me.
The good news, Argue says, is communities can improve the lives of kids and families if they start addressing these unmet needs. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
This story is part of a series of reports from Illinois Newsroom on the effects of gun violence across downstate Illinois. The problem often looks very different in rural parts of the state where suicides are driving gun-related deaths. Learn more about what's being done to reverse that trend tomorrow during Sound Ideas on GLT.
This Week in This American Life. Graham's a grown man now, but when he was a kid, he did something so dangerous, so comically dumb, it nearly killed him.
I used to wonder, you know, when the crime scene investigators came to look, what would they make of the whole setup? Would they even understand what had happened?
Returning to the scene later, Forensics for Beginners, that's this week. Listen Saturday at noon on GLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Kurtz Auto Body, serving McLean County and beyond for nearly 50 years. Auto body repair and painting covered by a limited lifetime warranty. Professional estimates with no appointment needed. Details at KurtzAutobody.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, your fecund garden future with GLT's Grow. Love, laughter, and breathtaking history highlight the 2018 season of the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. As the actors arrive in town to begin rehearsals, Laura Kennedy has this preview of the major cultural event of the summer.
This season, the Illinois Shakespeare Festival deftly combines the thrill of both a battle and a heart won. Familiar faces revisiting cherished roles, and a chance to imagine what if about the man himself, William Shakespeare. The 2018 season kicks off July 5th with The Merry Wives of Windsor, Henry V, and for the first time at the festival, Shakespeare in Love. The trio of plays are just a part of what the festival has to offer. That's according to John Stark, who's been a production designer with the festival for years, and this season makes his debut as artistic director. Stark says the festival staff is going into this season on a high note, thanks to the Chicago Tribune dubbing the Illinois Shakespeare Festival as one of the 20 must-see cultural attractions in the state of Illinois.
I subscribed to the paper, I opened it up, and there we were, number one. I thought, that's where we need to be, number one.
Did you not see that coming? Didn't they warn you or anything?
They actually did warn us a little bit. We had an idea that it was coming, but I did open it up. It's still fun to actually see the article right there in front of you in the travel section of the Trib.
So now you've got this. Everybody in the state of Illinois has read this, and probably elsewhere, and you're heading into your first season as artistic director at the Shakespeare Festival. Any nerves?
Any nerves? Of course. It's like you. It's sort of like the Field of Dreams. You know, if you plan it, will they come? But we know we have faithful fans of the Shakespeare Festival for all those artistic directors that preceded me, and I know that they will. I know that we have such great patrons in this community and around the region that we know that they'll come. And tickets are selling, so that's a good sign. So
already now, is that unusual that they should be selling this soon?
We have season tickets out there. And it's been something that's been there, but we've picked up the pace. It's doing well, and season tickets are still available, and they're still a bargain. You essentially can get three shows for the price of two by going to season tickets route. And so there, our season ticket sales are up, and so we feel good about that.
So let's talk about those three shows. You're doing The Merry Wives of Windsor, which is a great... could we call it a romantic comedy? Because there is a little bit of romance, not terribly romantic, but there's attempts at romance in it with Falstaff.
That's the whole gist of it, is Falstaff, in his attempt to romance the Merry Wives of Windsor. Our Windsor is going to be the Windsor Economy Suites of Normal, Illinois.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not. Our Merry Wives are going to, it's going to take place in Normal, Illinois in 1978, shortly after the famous Grateful Dead concert that was held here in Normal on the ISU campus. And so we're setting it there to have a lot of fun with it and have fun with the era, the time period. And that happens to be the year that the Illinois Shakespeare Festival started, 1978. So we thought that was a good year to pick.
So who's directing?
Deanna Gent, who's from St. Louis, is directing. She's the artistic director at Mustard Seed Theater in St. Louis.
Yes.
And she's on the faculty at Fontbonne University and an Illinois Wesleyan grad, by the way.
So she knows the area.
She does. She lived here for several years while going to school, and she's visited. Her son also attended Wesleyan, so she knows the area.
Who is your Falstaff?
Our Falstaff is a returning Falstaff. He was our Falstaff in the 90s for Henry Four Parts One and Two. Steve Young, who was a student of ours at that time. Steve has been around the world, because he also took up residence in England for a while. But he's now in the Dallas area, and he's returning to be our Falstaff. And so he's continuing that role into this show.
Since you have Falstaff as the main character of The Merry Wives of Windsor, can we see the show drinking some Shakespeare?
We're going to be selling Shakespeare.
Get out of here.
From a local brewery that is as our supplier of Shakespeare.
Who's your brewer?
White Oak Brewer. Brewery supplies our beer for the summer. They started with us last summer. We are anticipating another summer of Shakespeare.
Well, you'll also be doing Henry V, which is just about one of the most quotable of all of Shakespeare's plays.
Yeah, once know? More unto the breach.
Yes, so, we right. few, we happy few. Few.
All of those. I like the histories, and it's one of my favorites. It's an inspiring play, and it's very noble, heroic, and really, it's the end of the tetralogy of the Richard II and the Henry IVs, Part 1 and 2, and into Henry V, and we see where we end up with King Henry.
Who is playing your King Henry?
King Henry is a returning actor. He was with us last season, Jordan Cofftrey.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and he also was in Failure, a Love Story several years ago. And he has finished his MFA at the University of Illinois, and he was with us last season. So this is his third year with ISF, and we're proud to have Jordan back.
Well, in addition to The Merry Wives and Henry V, you're doing Shakespeare in Love. Now, why did you choose to do this show? It's your first season.
Yeah, well, Shakespeare in Love, it's being done around the country. It came around several seasons ago. It started in England, appropriately so, I think. Been the last two seasons, it's been done at Stratford, Ontario. Last season, I saw it in Cincinnati, in Utah Shakespeare, at Chicago Shakespeare. So it's a very popular piece right now.
And people can relate to it because they've probably seen the film with Gwyneth Paltrow.
Right. The 1999 film Academy Award winner is known. And the play is very, very close to it. The plot is very similar with a few changes because of the stage play version. And I think it's just great fun. It's connected to Shakespeare. And we've done that several seasons where we've been doing plays that are connected to Shakespeare. Last year, we did the I Heart Juliet,
yes,
which was the Q Brothers' take on Romeo and Juliet, which is definitely not your everyday Romeo and Juliet.
Because it's hip-hop.
It's hip-hop, right. We're doing things that are connected to Shakespeare, and it's just great fun. It is definitely a rom-com. It's definitely a romantic comedy, Shakespeare Love, and there are bits of Shakespeare in it, and it's fun to think about where did Will's inspiration come from? And here's this character that they created, a Viola, and it all makes sense, and yet it's fictionalized. But it's great fun, and there's a bit with a dog. So.
Yeah, you had to have dog auditions just this past weekend. How'd that go?
It went well. We feel that we've made our selection. We've hired our probably what will be our most popular actor of the season, Dogtor.
Dogtor is his name?
Yes, his name is his name, Dogtor. And he comes from Morton, Illinois. He's a perfect scruffy Shakespeare Love dog.
And all you have to do is pay him in kibble.
That's right. It's true. We have dog treats all over the place. Yeah. And we're really looking forward to having him as part of our company.
Well, having a dog tour for the first time is something new. But going back to your past, you're bringing back Mooney the Magnificent.
Yes, Mooney is going to be with us. That's Phil Johnson, who acted, I can't even think of the seasons, maybe 12 seasons or 13 seasons with the festival. I worked with him many years over the past years when I was designing for the festival. And Phil he created Mooney here at Illinois Shakespeare Festival. He started working on him back in the 80s, but really formalized it in the early 90s. And he is now Phil's main source of performance. Phil performs all year long at the Bristol Renaissance Fair as Mooney, and also other Renaissance fairs, not just that one, but that one around the country. Mooney is our silent clown, but if you come to the performance on June 30th, there's going to be two shows that day, an afternoon aimed at children and kiddies, but the evening you may have a special surprise about Mooney and the silent clown. The evening show will be it's a show that Phil is developing as Mooney. And this is going to be the premier performance of it. And
it's a great title, To Flop or Not to Flop.
It is. And so we're really looking forward to it, that we can support someone who's been at the core of our Shakespeare family for decades now, and that we can help him by giving him a venue, but he helps us by appearing in town. And he has lots of fans. And if you've not seen Mooney, or if your children certainly haven't, because he hasn't been here for a few years, you'll have great fun.
You're also bringing back the Improvised Shakespeare Company.
Well, they've been with us several seasons. They'll be with us for three performances this summer, and this whole schedule can be found on our website, illinoisshakes.com. You can look at all the events, but they are a fantastic group. They make up a brand new show right in front of your eyes, and they do it all in Shakespearean iambic pentameter, or mostly iambic pentameter.
You're also continuing the Illinois Shakespeare Festival Theater for Young Audiences, so you're basically bringing up the next generation of Shakespeare fans, and you've got a play called Double Double by Nancy Steele Brokaw.
Yeah,
from here in the Twin Cities.
Yeah, she's right here. She's our local playwright. She has penned a play that is going to be featuring putting William Shakespeare and Abraham Lincoln in the same play.
Wow!
And because Lincoln was a big fan of Shakespeare.
Oh, cool.
And he kept a complete works next to him a lot, and he had favorite plays, including that Scottish play.
Which, it's so sweet you won't say it. Yeah, I won't say it either.
Okay. So that was one of his favorites. But Nancy has worked in several parts, not only of that play, not only the Scottish play, but other bits of other Shakespeare into this story of about a fictionalized meeting of the two of them, and how Shakespeare's language and thoughts helped Lincoln formulate his presidency and some of the big choices he faced as president.
So the kids get a great dose of art and history.
That's the idea, is that they have a little bit of Lincoln in terms of our bicentennial year.
That's
here
right.
In Illinois. And we thought it was a great mirroring. We're going to have other Lincoln events too, in terms of some lecture series on Saturdays. And so there's a lot going on in that realm across the state. We're doing our part at Illinois Shakespeare Festival.
That's John Stark, Artistic Director of the Illinois Shakespeare Festival, which is currently in rehearsals for the 2018 season beginning July 5th. I'm Laura Kennedy.
The Illinois Shakespeare Festival also offers a summer, or rather midsummer, day camps, which encourage 1st through 12th graders to learn communication skills, problem-solving techniques, collaboration, and creative expression. There's a great way to make sure the future is verdant and bountiful. Patrick Murphy tells how we can all help in this edition of GLT's Grow.
A great way to preserve genetic diversity of plants is with a seed bank. I'm Laura Kennedy, and this is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert in the field. From the Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and curator of the Fell Arboretum, it's Patrick Murphy. Hello, Murph.
Good day, Laura.
Today on GLT's Grow, we're learning about seed banks and their importance, and we have a seed bank right here at Illinois State University.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity to share that with everybody. Here at Illinois State University, the director of the Department of Biology, Dr. Craig Gatto, has given me the privilege of utilizing a cold closet that already is filled with wooden cabinets and a multitude of drawers. And it is an unbelievable opportunity to start saving some of the Fell Arboretum's lineage and trading it with the lineage of other professional gardens across America and perhaps internationally, because these germplasm seed banks are all over the place.
Why are they important, Murph?
They are important because they aid in preserving the lineage of fauna in a specific area, or more specifically, they can be related to, there are depositories that focus on pears, mm-hmm. potatoes,
wow.
corn. There's one in Urbana that's corn-based.
Of course.
Corn-related. Yeah, I know.
Welcome to
How
Central
about
Illinois.
Surprise! Guess what's for lunch? Popcorn! Yeah. And in America, there are 9 germplasm depositories, and they not only collect seeds there, but they have tissue and other genetic resources, as they're called, to preserve plants specifically. They're scattered across the country in an attempt to protect and isolate them, you know, so to save them, but also they are the holding place for plants in a specific region. And some of them are understandable, but some are interesting. And so the ones that I found understandable would be like Davis, California. There's big time diversity out there. And then you also have Fort Collins, Colorado, which is pretty close to Cheyenne Mountain.
Mm-hmm.
That's where all important people are probably going to run if there's any kind of nuclear war. And they're going to be able to eat lots of seeds, apparently, because they're really close to each other. And there's actually been some news about depositories in Scandinavia that had problems,
yes.
and they had to empty them out and
oh.
start over certain stuff. And the simple reason or explanation behind that is not all seeds can be mixed together. Some bring parasitic mold. Some have other things that come with them that are harmful to a different seed.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of the germplasms use chiropreservation to preserve seed, tissue, and other genetic material.
So they freeze them?
They freeze them. But it's a little more complicated than just freezing them. Like when, you know, we all know the recipe for ice. It's not as simple as that. There's some moisture levels involved with the cooling, and desiccation can happen. It can be too dry. It can be too wet.
Oh, so you really got to get it just
yeah,
as the Goldilocks
that's
kind
right.
of thing.
And that kind of highlights the limitation that we talked about, is you can't mix some seeds together. They might have to be isolated a little bit further. Another interesting point is, you know, talking about the numbers in these germplasms. The USDA germplasm has over 835,000 specimens. That means from different living things.
Yes.
Compare that to the Washington State University's Pullman Farm, they alone have 93,500.
Mm-hmm.
And I like mentioning that one because those are largely plants that are from the Olympic Peninsula. Never been there? You should go. It's
oh.
amazing, right?
Uh-huh.
All the humongous stuff is there. But
like redwoods and things?
Redwoods are there. Everything that grows there is bigger because the growing conditions are great. The redwoods that grow out in that area, they're amazing trees because they're taking in moisture through their above ground parts and not just their roots. They're so large.
You're listening to GLC's Grow, our weekly gardening show for those who like to get their hands dirty. This week, we're talking about seed banks, and you're in charge of the seed bank here at Illinois State University.
I'm in charge, and it's just getting started. So we've just crossed the housekeeping threshold, you
oh.
know, so there was corn for trait research being stored in this cold closet before I was given the opportunity to utilize it. Some of that corn is still in there and will remain because it's good to preserve other people's research. And there's enough room for everyone in there.
So what are you putting in there, Murph?
Well, what we're doing with the help of students at Illinois State University is we're creating a collections calendar based on what we have here at the Arboretum. So you might start with maples that are in the Acer family. Not all maples will have their seeds collected at the same time. There's some diversity within that genus.
Oh, wow.
So we're going to repeat that for everything, and we're going to determine that. But I have a small collection of seeds that I've saved already, and they're a reflection of my personal preference.
Oh, yeah?
They're
like, what's in there?
They're not as scientific. Well, I have seeds from all the dogwoods except for Cornelian cherry dogwoods. And I don't have those for the reason that we've talked about, that there's a lot of pulp and stuff on that seed. And it takes a while to get all of that stuff off there properly
mm-hmm.
And have it mixed with the other seeds that don't have that droop on the outside of them, that mushy jelly bean looking thing. So a lot of the dogwood seeds come off and they're ready to go right into storage. There's not much separation of other tissue or anything like that. I've also started collecting the seeds from lots of magnolias. We have a wonderful magnolia collection here at Illinois State University.
They've been so beautiful this spring.
They are really looking fantastic right now, today. If you haven't come out to the Arboretum this year, it's time to get in touch with me and plan a walk.
You know, I got a question. What if we wanted to start our own seed bank at our own home? Could we do that?
I think it's an absolutely fabulous idea, for the same reason that it's a good idea for ISU and any other organization that's managing a public garden space, so you can share. So some of the seeds that might be kind of trite to one homeowner might be real exciting to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And hawthorn seeds are something that are interesting and fun to save because there are a lot of diversity in hawthorn species, and they're a common plant here in the Midwest. But there are plenty of others that fit the bill.
You know, I used to, I grew hollyhocks for a lot of years, and the hollyhocks that I grew came from seeds that my sister had from her home in Geneseo, which was built before the Civil War. So we have no idea how long those hollyhocks have been growing there.
Right.
So I kind of felt like it was this cool connection to the past, that she took the seeds from those hollyhocks, she gave them to me, and then I shared my hollyhock seeds with a neighbor as well. And they could have been coming from plants that have been growing since, like, the 1850s.
Within the last 48 hours, I had somebody from ISU contact me about a donor tree that's already here on campus, and they contacted me because the tag for the donor dedication is missing.
Oh.
And when they asked me if I knew about the tree, I said, matter of fact, I have. I've noticed that flowering cherry has never had fire blight. Now, it could be because Japanese flowering cherries are more resistant to fire blight. But it's also possible that we've got some lineage that has a little bit of resistance to a very common disease here.
So that seed could help them, help scientists.
That's right. That's right. And I'm not a scientist, for the record, but I would like
to
be supportive of them. So I'm not claiming that we have a scientific threshold here, but I am claiming that it's the world is so small, and the germplasms are just another example of that, that we collect the seeds from this Japanese flowering cherry. There may be people in the Department of Mathematics where that tree is close to that are particularly interested in it. And that evolves into another opportunity for a fell arboretum plant sale that's different from ones we've had in the past.
Okay, Murph. Well, thank you so much for filling us in on the whole seed library thing. Now, next week on GLT's Grow, I'm going to sound very philosophical here, so bear with me. It's how to water and how not to water.
Oh, yeah.
Not talking about technique there, but a ways of avoidance and doing some good for the environment as well. That is coming up next week on GLT's Grow. And we'd love your questions, too. If you've got something you'd like Merck to take on, we'll go to our website, WGLT.org, fill in the form, and send that right along to us. Feel free to include a photo in your gardening question. Just submit those questions at WGLT.org/grow.
You can subscribe to the GLT Grow podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Kansas City native Samantha Fish says veering into different shades of blues and roots music with each new album release keeps her creativity sharp. The now New Orleans resident has been a darling of blues music critics since her first release on Roof Records 7 years ago. Ahead of her show tomorrow night at the Castle Theater in Bloomington, Fish tells GLT's John Norton via Skype she was well aware of her hometown's reputation growing up, which helped inspire her own music.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Kansas City's there's such a steep tradition there, and it's a great blues town in a lot of ways, jazz and blues, there was a jam scene. I mean, you could go out every night and play with some really incredible top-notch blues players, and so I think just having access to that almost on a daily basis, and then also there was a club that I frequented a lot called Knuckleheads that had a lot of national acts come through, and I would just kind of go and soak up that kind of live music experience up close. It was, you know, that really was, you know, formative for me.
Do you remember being at Knuckleheads and being especially impressed with an artist or two that maybe inspired you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I saw, like, you know, Michael Burks and Tab Benoit, and, you know, there was a lot of country and rockabilly and Americana, not, you know, as well as blues stuff. It's kind of an all well-rounded honky-tonk.
What's the Kansas City music scene like today?
You know, I've been out of it for a minute, so I'm not exactly positive, but I know that there's some really great bands coming out there. I mean, my sister's there, so she's amazingly talented, and she's been playing in Kansas City. I mean, there's a lot of great local bands there. Blood on the street, tonight a new day. Lost count of how many died, at least I'm doing it my way. You're the liberated, you are the free. Free to cry and die disenfranchised, blessed is the country.
This is GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. The song is called American Dream from the new album by Samantha Fish. It's called Belle of the West. You mentioned you live in New Orleans now. What's the draw down there? The lively music scene, the warm weather, what?
I think the palm trees definitely helped.
Doesn't hurt, does
and
it?
And also, most of my band is out of New Orleans, so logistically it was definitely a good thing to move to. And also just to come home and be inspired by things off of the road. I don't know, I've been drawn to this place for about 5 years now, and just decided to make the jump.
What's it been like in New Orleans? Has it been everything that maybe you thought it might be?
Yeah, I mean, really, it's a jumping off point for touring. I spend most of my time on the road right now. But when I come home, there's a lot of opportunity to record and write, and then just go, experience live music on pretty much on a daily basis. If you want to go out and get inspired, you could do it that way, or just, take in the scenery of the city is pretty inspiring in and of itself.
Yeah, there's like a band or a musician on every corner, at least in the French Quarter and other places, right?
Oh, it's crazy.
Yeah. So is that inspirational in itself?
I think so. I think just having music around you all the time is something that's helpful. And, and then I can kind of steal away and go to my, into my quiet quarters and get creative.
So any of that second line stuff, any of that, big brassy jazz band stuff, is that going to seep into your music anytime soon?
Right now I have a horn section out of this city. When we did Chills and Fever, we brought New Orleans horns to that Detroit kind of R&B sound. And, so the horns have been a part of the band for over a year now. And as far as like second line type stuff, I mean, I'm kind of got my... my paths that I work through. We're kind of like in the rock and roll, Americana, soul, blues category. I don't know how much second line can pop in there, but I'm sure certain aspects of the city are going to rub off on the music in some ways. You never know.
When it's late at night, and when you hold me tight, tell me that you love me so. Never, ever, ever let me go.
It's a title track of the Chills and Fever album by our guest Samantha Fish. She put that out a little over a year ago now. And her new album is called Belle of the West. And like the Chills and Fever, it's kind of a left turn, or a second left turn for you in the last year or so. This one more Americana than the R&B-ish sound of Chills and Fever. The decision to go in this direction and change directions like that, you were considered a pretty straight-up blues artist for a number of years. How much of this is a financial decision as much as an artistic decision to move in a different direction?
Well, I mean, financially, it's a great decision, because it brought us to many more people. But at the same time, my band got twice as big. So I don't know. It's kind of like a profit-loss scenario there. I mean, really, it was a creative decision. It's something I've wanted to do for a long time. But you come back to, when I first started playing music, you want to talk about finances. The economic decision was the trio for sure. So, I mean, I started out small because that's really the best way to start on the road. Keep it small. And after Wild Heart came out, it just felt like time. I'd always wanted to expand. And here we were with this, things were growing and moving in a positive direction. So it was just the right time to do that.
Well, we're playing the Belle of the West title track right now. And this is a straight up country song for you.
It definitely is. It's Jimbo Mathis wrote that song, and he brought it to the session. It was like, I think this one's perfect for you. And it ended up being the title track just because I feel like it spoke volumes to what the album is,
She's the Belle of the West, just a painted lady, rolling down the big muddy.
Well, Jimbo is known as quite the producer, and certainly what, deep into blues, deep into roots. What did he bring to the table for you that was a little bit different?
Well, I've been a fan of his for, you know, a number of years. And actually, I mean, Luther Dickinson brought him in because it was Luther produced the record. And and he brought in his friends, Lightnin' Malcolm and Jimbo Mathis and Lily May and these wonderful players from Memphis, Mississippi, Nashville area. And I mean, what Jimbo brings is a whole lot of soul. I mean, everything he touches gets his character on it. And, you know, I'm such a fan of his work that I wanted him all over that record because he's really phenomenal.
So you mentioned you're on the road an awful lot, and you like to get home to New Orleans when you can. But when you're on the road, I imagine you're writing songs as well. How do you avoid writing songs when you're on the road that much? How do you avoid writing songs about being on the road?
That's tough because you know they always say when you get stuck, you write about what you know.
Right.
And that seems to be kind of my whole world for the last 5 years has been on the road. You know, I think just trying to stay connected to stuff outside of it. For you, she dreamed of this day.
Never once thinking of home. Now she sat down. Samantha Fish speaking via Skype with GLT's John Norton. Fish plays the Castle Theater in Bloomington. Tomorrow night, Fish's music can be heard on GLT Blues Radio at WGLT.org. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois on the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham, John Norton, and Laura Kennedy. Find the full show podcast at WGLT.org or Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 GLT, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.